first introducing Tim Brooks. Tim Brooks is the director of the professional writing program at Champlain College in Burlington, Vermont. His Endangered Alphabets project made its first public appearance in May 2010, as did his book, Endangered Alphabets. He is also the founder of the Champlain College Publishing Initiative, and the most recent of his 12 books is The Story So Far, Essays on Publishing in the 21st Century. Tim.
So now I'm completely confused as to how long I have to talk. So you really are going to have to use.
All right, will is. I will.
Okay, good. Good deal. Okay. So I think picking up on some of Mark's observations, it's a sign of how diverse and how many different angles the whole issue of cultural and language endangerment touches on that. I come here not as a linguist or an anthropologist or even really much of an academic. And in addition to that, I'm also not an artist or a woodworker. So I'm really a writer by background. And I stumble on this very much by accident. So normally I talk at a minimum of like 3.5 hours, and then they have to drag me kicking and screaming from the room. So you're really going to need those flashcards. What I'm actually going to do is to talk about some of these pieces. I'm going to pass them around because one of the interesting features of language today and creativity today is that we are living in the most creative period in the history of the universe, as far as we know. But most of it's happening in two dimensions on a screen. And one of the things that I find is that the sort of the clunky retro appeal of this chunk of wood is something that people really like. So I'm going to pass them around, and please do not carve your initials on them. Otherwise, you can do pretty much anything you want to with them, sniff them, and all this kind of stuff. So some of these I'm going to talk about in terms of the endangerment of the culture and why these particular scripts are minority or endangered or virtually extinct. Some of them I'm going to talk about some of the other issues that they bring up in terms of language. And this is why I was so interested to have discussions about language as a whole. Because, for example, when you start carving a language as opposed to writing it or printing it or reading it, your relationship with it changes dramatically. And the way I got into this, in fact, was that I started out carving signs one Christmas when I had no money for all of my family as Christmas presents. And then, having given everybody a sign, I started carving things in Chinese purely because I had a hole in the wall that I need to fill that was vertical. And so I thought, oh, Chinese vertical, I'll start carving some of that stuff. But as soon as I started carving Chinese, I began to realize that, of course, the brush has the same wrist relationship as a gouging tool, for example. And I found that the act of carving a script, which is still a script in the sense of having clear origins in the act of physically writing, was straight away different from carving something which is essentially typographic or is the result of a mechanical reproduction. So that was really pretty interesting, and that was when I started researching the backgrounds and origins of some of these, and also starting to think about writing in general. I should point out that this is not the original Endangered Alphabets exhibition, which I discovered would cost $1,000 one way to ship here. Mm. This is Alphabets Light, in the same way as like Bud Light and Miller Light. So I carved these specifically for this trip so that they would fit into my luggage. And therefore they would cost me nothing except by Ryanair, who charges a huge amount for every kind of overage. Many of the pieces I work with now are much bigger than this, or more elaborate, or contain more text. Each of these says the word words. I sort of thought it was nice to circulate words amongst us as we're interested in this kind of thing. So I'm going to move through these and pass them around. and say a few words about these and then scoot off the stage. This is the first one I want to talk about because this really illustrates some of the points that Mark was making about what is happening right now in terms of endangered. I feel like the girl that goes on stage between the bouts, you know, between the rounds of the boxing match. So this is Chakma. So I was in Bangladesh on a public health project a couple of years ago, and before I went there, I said sent out a general request to linguist list saying, by the way, are there any endangered alphabets in Bangladesh? And sure enough, there are actually several, and they really illustrate a number of things that I think are issues that are going to be very familiar to many of you. So in Bangladesh, you have an official script and an official language, both of which are Bengali. But you also have a very large portion of the country, possibly as much as, I would say, a sixth in total landmass, called the Chittagong Hill Tracts. And in that area, you have at least 13 genetically individual indigenous peoples. Each of those has their own language. Many of them have their own script and their own literary tradition. So one of those groups is the Chakma. I believe there are about 300,000. Of the Chakma, a handful still read and write Chakma, even though it is the, you know, the language of their heritage, their history, their ancestors. So I want to tell you about the person who gave me this particular piece of script. His name is Shantimoy Chakma. So his father was a Chakma writer, a Chakma intellectual, and one who was really involved in researching and preserving his people's history and also converting global issues into Chakma for his people to understand. So the army came into their village and burned it down twice. The second time they killed his father. At this point, Shanti was four. And one of the interesting features of this was that at a stroke, they destroyed not only his familial connection with his own language, but his cultural connection to his own culture's history. He grew up not being able to read and write Chakma. So consequently, he actually had to get somebody else to write this out for me. Chakma is available in Unicode form, and so they sent me this. But as a sign of how this is turning around, 2 days ago, I was lucky enough to meet a young man who's actually from the Mro people in the Chittagong Hill Districts, who's the first of his people ever to study in the United States. He came to his village was burned down twice. He was essentially educated as a refugee within his own country and homeschooled by his own mother because when he was being taught in school, the teacher was talking in Bengali and he couldn't understand it. And he spoke four of these indigenous languages, but he did not speak the national language of his country. And so he got homeschooled. He managed to make his way here. He got a degree in engineering and he's now doing a master's in teaching. He's been back to the Chittagong Hill Districts and he's built a school for his people. And he's in the process of creating a series of school books for the kids in Chakma, which is, of course, really important because kids are growing up completely unable to read, write, or in some cases speak their own people's language. One of the reasons why I think speaking about endangered alphabets in the context of endangered languages is that he and I are going to do a presentation at Harvard where I'm going to be carving a series of texts in wood in Chakma and Mro and Marma and a couple of other minority scripts. And he's going to be talking about his background, and this is going to raise, we hope, a variety of kinds of interests, which mean that essentially, when he goes back to Bangladesh, he's less likely to be arrested and imprisoned. Because if we can hang the tag you know, Harvard, Cambridge, on this kind of thing, he is essentially somewhat safer than he would be on his own. And in particular, if obviously we also get some NGO attention drawn to it, then that makes it that much harder for the government to do things like they have done, which is to essentially hire an impersonator who looks like him to go on television and say, I did not say these things in the United States. So that's Chakma. I'm going to pass this one around, and feel free to have a look at that. Which one else should we look at? So this, you may notice a certain similarity between the T-shirt and this one. So this is actually, I have to say, my favorite script in purely visual terms. This is Balinese. Balinese is endangered for an unusual reason, which is that when Indonesia became a nation after the Second World War, it was, in essence, dozens of nations previously, many of which had their own literary traditions going back centuries. As soon as a government decided that in the name of national and political unity, they would have one language and the script would be the Roman script, the schools and business, government, etc., stopped using the Balinese script. The Balinese language continues, but it was immediately being written in the Roman script. So it actually took me 2 years to find somebody who could write my original piece of text for the original exhibition in Balinese. And so once again, this says words. This is the result of another Kickstarter campaign. We were talking about the importance of Kickstarter nowadays. So I did a series of carvings in Balinese for a woman down in D.C. who is starting a project to revive the Balinese language in both spoken and written forms. So she would offer these carvings to anybody who gave her more than a certain amount of money. The project was successful, and so now she's making a series of documentaries. She's doing some oral history work. She's interviewing people back in Bali. So there is this really interesting sense in which a visual representation of a language is not only an embodiment of phonetics and semantics, it can also be a gift. There is a sense in which that once you reify what we think of as being a medium of communication, you turn it into something else, which can be potentially something of value, which is obviously something which worked in her case, and we hope is going to continue working. By the way, the wood that these are carved in, this is Vermont curly maple. I get it from a farmer and logger who lives up in northern Vermont. His workshop is literally twice the size of this room because he has to be able to back his logging truck into it. And when I go up to the roof, he has, I would say, several thousand of these amazing planks, many of which are maple that are this tall and still have the bark on both sides, which is the stuff that I really like to use. This one is fascinating because I thought it was extinct. Okay, hands up all those who know which one this is. Some of you must. I mean, this is a learned bunch. Okay, this is... No prizes. I was going to give a Kit Kat. This is glagolitic. So I was invited to give a talk at a conference organized by the crossword puzzle editor of the New York Times. Who knew? I mean, really, who knew? When is this going, your career path, right? And he happened to mention that when he had been in Eastern Europe, he had seen this fascinating and very strange and frankly inefficient and kind of messy script. And what was it? And I said, you know, I believe it may have been glagolitic, which I know nothing about because it's extinct. It turns out glagolitic is not extinct. And in fact, it represents something that, again, fits into your opening remarks very neatly. So glagolitic was one of two scripts that was used, was actually invented to write Old Church Slavonic, which was, as you know, the early church feuded between the Greek church and the Roman church. The Roman church expanded north and west, the Greek church expanded northeast, etc. And when the early I guess you would call them missionaries, moved into the Balkans and the Slavonic regions, they had a very snooty attitude towards Slavic writing, which they said, being pagan consisted just in dots and lines. And so they invented Glagolitic in part to show what a script that really embodied the true word of the Lord should look like. So if you like, this is the stained glass window of scripts. It didn't matter that it was really difficult to write or anything like that. The important thing is that it would show spiritual and intellectual authority and superiority. So not surprisingly, it began to fall into slow decline over a period of time. Especially as Cyrillic was invented around the same time for the same purpose. But it turns out, ladies and gentlemen, that Glagolitic was still being used by literally two priests on the island of Cook off the Dalmatian coast. And also by certain other people. Like apparently there's a tradition that if you buy a fishing boat, you write its name in Glagolitic on the side of the fishing boat. So in my mind, this is now the fishing boat script, right? And there's a restaurant which writes its recipe in, it's a menu in Glagolitic. So anyhow, so I'm thinking, this is all very interesting, but you know, I'm not doing extinct stuff, I'm just doing endangered stuff. It turns out that with the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, the need to create a sense of national or ethnic identity and history becomes that much greater. And the Croatians in particular have seized on Glagolitic as being an element of their cultural history. It wasn't the only place where Glagolitic was used by any means. And apparently now, if you go to the island of Cook, you'll find that school children are being taught Glagolitic. It's not clear if they can actually understand it or they can read it, but they're certainly taught the letters. And so what we're starting to see, not only here, but also, for example, among the Cherokee and among the Tagalog, which we'll come on into in a minute, is a sense of a written language which is not a written language and does not correspond to a spoken language. It's a written language that is a kind of cultural branding or self-identifying. And I'll pass the Glagolitic along and I'll pull up the Tagalog. So this one is, I find, interesting for many, many reasons, most of which I won't get into. But continuing from what I was just saying, so this is Bebeyan, or the Bebeyan, which was the script when the Spanish turned up in Luzon in, I think it was 1556. Yes? No? Come on, this is Cambridge. Someone should know this. Really? Not out of 10.
Okay. Not out of period.
Very good. Very good. So when the Spanish turned up in the Philippines, they discovered to their surprise that the natives could already write. And they had a script which had actually developed from this one. The reason they look so different is that this was written on palm leaves. This is Lontara from the Lontar palm, which was the Bugis people from Sulawesi who went throughout Australasia. And they taught it to the Tagalog. And the reason it looks completely different is that this was not done on palm leaves. This was incised in bamboo using the point of a knife, which is why it's so curly and so thin. And then they would take a handful of ash and rub it into the bamboo to make it stand out. So, of course, classic story of imperialism, when the Spanish turn up, anybody who wants to get ahead in the world learns Spanish, learns to write the Latin alphabet, etc. And typically, again, Bebeyan retreats to the lower classes, the rural people, the hill people, etc., etc. So, about 10, 12 years ago, a Canadian called Paul Morrow, who lived in Winnipeg, got very interested in Filipino culture because he was living in an area where there are a lot of Filipinos. And so he learned Tagalog, and he got interested in this. And so he found a number of documents written in the 17th century in Bebeyan, and he created He really did early Unicoding and created what is called a stylized Bebeyan font. Now, he also discovered, no, it wasn't him, it was me, damn it. I also discovered that the other people who were still using Bebeyan as a script were tattoo artists. So once again, this year we're talking about a traditional script retreating into its areas of kind of safety and off the beaten track nest. And so it turned out that, and again, as part of this resurgence of national identity, young bloods in the Philippines were getting themselves tattooed with Bebeyan characters, sort of like, I can sort of imagine young Finns being tattooed with like runes or something like that, same kind of thing. They didn't know what the characters meant, but they knew that they were part of their cultural history and that they were cool. It's a sign of how far this has now progressed, this sense of the re-embracing of the original script, that starting last year, the government now puts the denominations of its banknotes in the Latin alphabet and in Bebeyan. So you'll see it will say 100 pesos, I believe there'll be some character that absolutely nobody can read, but they assume it means 100. And, well, I assume it means 100 as well, frankly. So what we're, so pass this around. So what we're seeing then is this very curious sort of contrary motion taking place in scripts. We're seeing that on the one hand, there's the Facebook effect, where people who speak and write in endangered languages communicate with each other through Facebook using one of the, what is it, 12 scripts that Facebook uses or something like that. So there is this massive narrowing that's taking place. But at the same time, as you get this sense of a resurgence of a sense of cultural identity, this is Makassarese, by the way, also from Indonesia. As you get the sense of a resurgence of cultural identity, you have the return of scripts, some of which are being taught and people are learning, Cherokee being a good example. You get total immersion Cherokee schools, for example, right now. This is Vi, which is becoming at least somewhat viable, so to speak, in West Africa. There you go. But in many cases, it's existing as a visible symbol of history, of, in some cases, nationalism. In many cases, it's purely a graphic symbol. Some of these, I'm convinced, have appealed just because graphically they're so unique. And I'm going to leave you with a question at the end, because I sense my stop card is coming any second now. So this, many of you, I think, assume you know what this is, you're kind of going, yes, that's Chinese. Well, this is actually Nam. So Nam was the script used in Vietnam for 1,000 years. So what that means is that 1,000 years of Vietnamese history and literature, especially poetry, was written using this script, which has a lot in common with Chinese, but has been adapted in many ways to the Vietnamese language, to Vietnamese culture, to Vietnamese expression, etc. And as you might expect, it suffered from two forces, Christianization and imperialism. So when the missionaries first appeared, they were kind of going, no, we're going to have the word of the Lord in Latin because that's the language of the Lord, which is, you know, one of the great forces for the spread of all major alphabets has, of course, been the spread of religion. And then the French colonial authorities said, we are not having you messing around with this strange stuff. You know, you will write like us. But the reason I'm showing this to you is that there's a professor called John Balaban in North Carolina who has become the world's leading translator of Vietnamese poetry. And he has started the Vietnamese Non-Preservation Foundation. And you can actually go to the website and you can learn about it and you can actually do one of those things where you put a word in and it will give you the Non-equivalent. But I was exhibiting this at a private school in upstate New York, and there was a Chinese student in attendance, and he asked a very interesting question. He said, how can this be an endangered alphabet if I can read it? And the answer is, it's an endangered alphabet because the Vietnamese can't. And one of the interesting things about this whole issue, as you know, of endangered languages and endangered alphabets and cultural endangerment in general, is that the people who don't really see the point are the people who are in no danger of becoming endangered. And for those who are, so to speak, at the other end of the gun, such as my friends in the Chittagong Hill Tracts, it's really, really clear what the issues are. It's really clear what the dangers are. And it's all too clear what the future may be. So I think I'm going to wind up right there. All of these, when we're done here, I'm going to be putting them out in the display cases out in the atrium area. Would you call that an atrium area? Okay, the atrial area out there. And I'm more than happy to meet you during the course of the day and answer questions about them. I only brought a couple of copies of my book, Endangered Alphabets, here. You can order this online at endangeredalphabets.com if you're interested, but I'll certainly leave this around. Actually, I'll leave this also in the atrial area so that you can flip through this and have a look at that. And without further ado, I'm going to pass all of this over to my colleague.